The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. It's coming home. England give us some nostalgia as Gareth Southgate's men remind us what supporting them used to be like before he took over. Just a blip, reasons for concern, or take the 3 points and never speak of it again. Two wins from two for Wales in similarly tedious circumstances, but a nice day for Neco Williams. Crisis for the Republic, a draw and a defeat for Stephen Kenny. Will Barry's heart rate climb higher than the average 1 beat a minute as he discusses his boys in green? Meanwhile, how good are Czech Republic reserves? We'll find out as they play Scotland tonight. And is Sid bored of telling us where Lionel Messi is? We'll ask him. We have the highlights of the Carabao Cup and news of the second round and, for some reason, the third round draw as well. Crisis at West Ham, one of those constants in life we all need. There's Wolves spending £35 million on a striker with one senior goal. Plenty of WSL fun as Miedema scores a cracker and Villa's defence forget the season has started. All that, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hello, Max. Welcome back.
Thanks so much. Did you miss me?
No, not really. It's pleasant not to have to look at your face staring at me from a laptop screen for an entire 2 weeks.
Oh, that's okay. Jacob Steinberg, hello.
Hello.
We will get on to West Ham in a moment. Are you excited to see it all falling apart before the season even begins there?
Yeah, it was quiet for a moment, so it's nice that it's back and crazy again, even before anything's happened.
Flo Lloyd-Hughes, good morning.
Good morning, Max.
How are you?
I'm very tired, but apart from that, I'm fine.
Why are you so tired?
Because I haven't really done much work in about 6 months, and I was working Saturday and Sunday quite far away, quite long hours, and yeah, my body has just become too lazy, so I need to build my energy back up to what it's like working in football.
Yeah. Are you complaining about being paid to watch football, Flo? I know listeners really like it when people do that.
No, but I am going to complain about working harder for being paid less money. That's what I will complain about, which I think is a justified result of the pandemic. Well, not justified, but obviously a reality of the pandemic. But unfortunately, the reality of most people who work in the football industry at the moment. So I'm sure lots of people will be sympathising.
Hashtag pray for Flo if you want to get that trending. I'm sure the Leeds fans especially and the Jack Grealish fans, that'll get together to support you. Let's start then with an absolute cracker. Iceland 0, England 1. Jacob, how painful did you find this football match?
Yeah, really painful. It was kind of, I guess, to be expected a little bit, given that the players have barely done anything for the last few weeks and some of them were coming in off very little training time, especially Harry Kane. That was a typical Harry Kane back from a bit of time off performance, although, you know, started brightly and had the goal disallowed. But obviously what happened with him with the quarantine and coming back from the Bahamas probably had an effect on his performance. So I guess you can slightly excuse what went on Saturday. I think that there's the argument that would be made by the club managers that this is a slightly ridiculous time to insert an international window, given everything that's gone on over the last few months. And it probably wasn't too much of a surprise to see quite a leggy performance from England. But at the same time, Iceland are that kind of team who can make it quite difficult, and they were ready to set back and make it an ugly game. So, yeah, it was it became pretty tedious performance, and probably coupled in, exacerbated by the way that Southgate kind of set up the team with the sort of double defensive pivot in midfield, which I think is a little bit of an issue for England to sort out, because I think he obviously knows his best attack, or at least he's got a lot of options there, and you can probably bring out one and bring in the other, and it probably wouldn't make too much of a difference, Rashford or Sancho. But in midfield, I don't think he knows his best combination yet, and it could be an issue going into the Euros next summer.
Could you put a positive spin, Barry, on Kyle Walker's performance?
I would struggle to put a positive spin on his performance. He got sent off, deservedly so, not in ideal circumstances, because I think some would argue he was lucky to be in the squad in the first place. I think possibly after his antics at the start of lockdown, people thought that was it for him, possibly at City and for England, but he's Pep welcomed him back into the City side, Southgate welcomed him back into the squad. But Look, I don't think it's much of a big deal that he did get sent off. I don't think the Nations League is even remotely significant for England because they always qualify for tournaments with ease anyway, and it's not a particularly prestigious international tournament. It's one that's worth winning, but not one they have their heart set on winning, like a European Championships or a World Cup.
You mentioned Harry Kane being a bit leggy, Jacob, and I'd lost so much interest that when England got a penalty and Raheem Sterling was taking it, I was thinking, why is Harry Kane not taking this penalty? I hadn't noticed that he'd been taken off. But I kind of see it as a very positive sign that Southgate took Harry Kane off, because I've seen manager after manager after manager refuse to substitute him regardless of what he's doing on a pitch. And I was worried that Southgate would also do that. So I thought, even though Kane is clearly vitally important to England, it's a positive sign that the manager can substitute him if he's not doing a whole lot.
Yeah, I think that Kane will always be in Southgate's team. I think there is a tendency at times from people to be a little bit too eager to write Kane off when he comes back from these injuries, and he looks a little bit slow at times. I think he did when they came back after lockdown. He'd actually not, unlike players who hadn't played for 3 months, he hadn't played for 6 months, and it was expected that really you should have expected him to not, you know, be at his absolute best straight away. And then towards the end of the season, actually, he was scoring goals at quite an impressive rate. And you sort of think, you know, he is a very good player. And I think that they'll, you know, England have all these exciting young forwards who are sort of breaking through now, and people will be quite eager to see some of them probably come into the side and start instead of him. But I think that Southgate will always have a place for him in the team when he can. At the same time, they do have the options. And if you can bring on someone like Mason Greenwood, who, you know, just came straight into the Man United side last season and scored, what, 15, 20 goals from nowhere, really. And when you can do that, it just shows the options that England have. It's something they didn't really have at the World Cup. I think that when they ran into a few difficulties in some of those tricky knockout games, Colombia included, they probably didn't have a lot off the bench to change it. And now he does have so many options in an attacking sense. And I think it's just up to him to work out the best way to use that. I think, you know, people were quite aggrieved that Grealish didn't get on Saturday. He had Mason Mount on the bench as well. You've got people even like Dele Alli and James Maddison who can't get in the squad. And you can see the Maddison issue potentially being something that's going to sort of follow Southgate around, much like the Grealish one. You know, is he going to use these creative players, or is he going to sort of go back towards the more safe option of having Declan Rice alongside someone else in midfield, which I think probably against the smaller teams can look a little bit cumbersome, and maybe against the bigger teams, does he trust the defence to hold out without the extra protection in midfield?
James Ward-Prowse played the whole game. What did you make of his penalty shithousery flow there, digging up the penalty spot? I seem to remember when a Colombia player did it in the World Cup, I was so angry about it. I couldn't really articulate my rage. For some reason, I wasn't bothered at all this time.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? It's funny how you just forget that a little bit. Yeah, it was pretty classic. I think, you know, his place in that side is long overdue. He's been consistently good for Southampton, so he deserves to start. And it's good to see, you know, different people playing in the team. I think that's the best way to create that competition as well, because I think England have struggled in the past when everyone knows that they have a spot in the team and they don't have anyone, you know, chasing them for that position, and they get comfortable. And we talked about that in Harry Kane in that sense. He knows that he's going to be the go-to choice. But I think it's important for Southgate to create that competition. And we mentioned in the midfield, there's lots of competition at the moment, but you need to create that competition all over the pitch. Otherwise, when you're playing Iceland in a Nation League game that no one really cares about, how are you going to motivate the players if it's not? It's probably, you know, a lot more about, well, do you want to stay in this international squad? And this is your chance to prove it, even if it's just a glorified friendly.
Tom says, given Barry's excellent minute by minute on the Tour de France over the weekend, who does he think would perform worse? Ineos Grenadiers playing football against Iceland, or the England team cycling yesterday's mountain stage?
I think the England team would not be able to cycle yesterday's mountain stage over the Pyrenees. Not sure they'd make it.
Would you play a double pivot? Would you because that's better for air resistance for whoever's sitting behind, you know, cyclist number
two. Well, I'd imagine the Ineos formation would just be 1-1-1-1-1-1-1-1. 8 of them lined up in a row.
They're constantly lacking width on those Tour de France phone-ins. People furious with the lack of width at Ineos. So England have got Denmark on Tuesday night. We're going to move tomorrow's pod to Wednesday to cover that and the rest of the Nations League. Denmark lost 2-0 to Belgium. Wales followed up their late win over Finland on Thursday with an even later win over Bulgaria. 19-year-old Neco Williams last gasp header in a pretty terrible game again after Kiefer Moore got their winner on Thursday in a pretty terrible game. But I guess, Barry, what's fun with Wales is the kind of mix of players that you have, you know, these young talents like Neco Williams alongside the big dirty target man Kiefer Moore from the championship and everything in between with sort of Gareth Bale on top of it.
Yeah, this game, it wasn't good. It's funny, the Nations League was brought in to eliminate these dreadful friendlies, and most of the games involving home nations over the weekend, or since Thursday, had the air about them of dreadful friendlies, which is a bit of a shame, but I'm struggling to find anything much to say about any of these games, really, which is... Not ideal, considering what we're doing.
It's what you're here for, Barry, to be perfectly honest.
But, I think the highlight of that game was like a biblical rainstorm during the second half, which was quite astonishing and prompted all the Wales substitutes and backroom staff to rush from the front of the stand to the back of the stand to get some cover. Neco Williams was clearly delighted to score on his first goal for his country. He's a very proud Welshman who England tried to poach. Again, in Bulgaria, they had a team who conceded late goals in both their games against the Republic of Ireland as well. They conceded at the death. Bulgaria are not a particularly good team. It was a decent win for Wales, keeps them unbeaten in 8. And otherwise, not really much to write home about.
I like that he says, my family's Welsh, fair enough, I'm Welsh, and my friends are Welsh. So it was always going to be Wales, as if he's not allowed to be friends with anybody who isn't Welsh. So it sort of limits you, I guess. I mean, there's a few million, aren't there? So that's enough. How many friends do you have, Jacob, would you say?
How many friends do I have?
Yeah.
I don't know. 10.
10. Yeah, sorry, you could have them all from one. Are they all the same nationality, Jacob? Or, you know, do you mix? Are you more cosmopolitan than Neco Williams?
My wife is Indian, so that makes me really cosmopolitan. I just leech off her.
Wales have won 4 consecutive games in competitive action for the first time since 2003, when they won 5 in a row under Mark Hughes. It's 1 point from 2 games to the Republic of Ireland. They followed up their draw with Bulgaria with a 1-0 home defeat to Finland, Stephen Kenny's first home game in charge. Kenny becomes the first Irish manager to lose his opening game in charge since Mick McCarthy in 1996. Kenny out, Baz?
Well, again, this was another terrible, terrible game. And I did notice on Twitter, actually, in the aftermath, there are people already calling for Stephen Kenny's head 2 games in. And I suppose what's interesting about this game, and there was very little interesting about it, is that Ireland have their Euros playoff semi-final coming up against Slovakia. And it's a bit of a dilemma for Stephen Kenny because he's trying to introduce this new style of expansive, free-flowing football, full-backs playing up high and getting up the pitch. And it's not working because the players he has at his disposal are quite limited and it will take time to implement this system. But time is something he doesn't really have with this very important game against Slovakia coming up. I think it's ludicrous that people are calling for his head, and I suspect the people who are calling for his head already, obviously it's people on a minority on Twitter, probably didn't want him there in the first place. And it's like the problem I alluded to last week, some are saying that he doesn't have the respect of the players because he's only managed in the League of Ireland. But look, he clearly needs to be given time. Mick McCarthy didn't start well. Jack Charlton didn't start well when he was manager of the Republic of Ireland. Giovanna Trapattoni, who got us to a major finals, he had a poor start. Michael O'Neill, when he manage Northern Ireland had a dreadful start, but you know, it takes time to implement this system. He deserves a chance. He did play an entirely different midfield in this game to the one he played against Bulgaria. Robbie Brady, Jason Malumbi and Harry Arter came in for Hourihan Hendrick and James McCarthy. I think he said, you know, because the players are tired, because they haven't, it's such a weird time. Is it pre-season? Is it post-season? No one knows how fit these players are. But I'm unconcerned. I hope he's given time. He will be given time. And hopefully he will implement his ideas.
And one of the biggest stories of the Nations League over this weekend is actually off the pitch, is with the Czech Republic. Scotland due to play them on Monday night tonight. Scotland drew with Israel in a similarly boring game of football. But the Czech Republic have had to name an entirely new squad for this game. The squad and coaching staff involved in Friday's win over Slovakia are in quarantine amid COVID-19 concerns. The new squad contains six players from Sigma Olomouc, who play at the Androv Stadium, where the game's going to be played. Two players are capped. Stanislav Tekl's got five caps. Romanov Hubnik is 36, scored a winning goal against Scotland in 2010, is coming out of retirement. It's an extraordinary story, Flo, isn't it? And the idea that the poor Czech Republic had to suddenly just ring around and find an entirely new squad of international footballers.
Yeah, I think there was an idea that the game was going to be called off, and then UEFA said, no, you have to play it. This really important match has to be played. And a bit like Barry mentioned, obviously Steve Clark's really main focus is this playoff game against Israel, who he's unfortunately already had to play and probably now a bit worried about a big playoff match next month. But it does seem a bit ridiculous to force this game through. But I guess the last thing that UEFA want is, you know, delayed matches that they force through to be played when the whole fixture list is already absolute chaos because of what happened last season. So I can understand why they force it through, but it does seem a bit ridiculous. But
I mean, imagine the uproar if this was England and then suddenly we had to, you know, it would just be absolutely, it would be mad, wouldn't it?
I guess for Scotland, it's a good opportunity to, you know, climb that Nations League table.
Are there implications of this, not just with international football, with club football, about what will happen if a squad in the Premier League in 3 weeks get COVID and what they'll have to do about it?
Well, we already saw it last week when you had the Chelsea had their big problem with, what was it, nine of their players in quarantine and an unspecified number testing positive. But it would seem that, you know, it's just sort of treated like injuries. The clubs have been told that you're going to have to play regardless of how many players you have out with in quarantine or, you know, in a positive test. If you can name, what, 14 players, then go with it. And if you have to name your youth team, then so be it. You know, that's it. But I find it unlikely that it would happen. I think that the Project Restart just kind of showed that the Premier League's protocols and health and safety protocols and the bubble that they were in clearly worked. And actually, it was the moment that they stepped out of it that that the problems occurred, where we were seeing some players going to quarantine after their holidays. I guess the issue may come when they are going abroad and on these foreign trips. I think, you know, there's going to be an implication. I think for West Ham, I think that Suchek will probably have to miss their first game because of this, which, you know, probably won't go down too well with David Moyes, because it probably wouldn't be something that would happen if he was just at Rush Green.
Patrick Schick is the other player who tested positive, and he's on the verge of a transfer from Roma to Bayer Leverkusen, so that's been delayed as well. It'll presumably still go through. But my understanding was the UEFA rule was that if you had 13 fit players, you have to play the game. But if the entire squad is in isolation, do you just keep going through fit men of a certain age until, you know, you pull some bloke off the street and go, right, hand him a jersey and off you go?
It's conscription.
Yeah,
that's what it is.
We could bring back the 96 squad, make them play, like, just get Nedved in.
Oh, Poborski in as well. It'd be nice. Like, make it like a charity game. A decent point for Northern Ireland in Romania. Down to 10 men, they got a late equaliser from Gavin White. Bailey Peacock-Farrell had a brilliant game in goal. Ian Barraclough's first game in charge. Now, I know we covered who he was on Thursday's show, Barry, but it was so boring that it got completely cut. Could you repeat it?
He stepped up to replace Michael O'Neill. He was the underage or the under 21 manager, and he's said that he's not really going to move too far from the blueprint that Michael O'Neill operated from, and it's worked for him so far. They obviously have a playoff game against Bosnia Herzegovina coming up, so that's what he has his eye on. And I think the main story revolving around Northern Ireland last week was the Adam Sykes, who Barraclough managed at under 21 level, declared for the Republic of Ireland, as anyone born in Northern Ireland is allowed to do. And that caused a bit of a palaver. I don't think Barraclough was too impressed, and the Northern Ireland FA weren't impressed either. It's happened before. James McLean, Darren Gibson, Shane Duffy are among other Northern Ireland underage players to have defected to the Republic, and I can understand their frustration because they've a very small pool of players to pick from, but you know, it's up to each individual, I suppose. I will, however, continue to be bitter about England nicking Jack Grealish and Declan Rice.
And then refusing to pick Jack Grealish. Elsewhere in the Nations League, Ansu Fati became the youngest player to score ever for Spain, breaking a 95-year-old record, the age of 17 years and 311 days. Would you like to know what was number one on his birthday, the 31st of October 2002, Jacob?
Yes.
The Long and Winding Road. By Will Young and Gareth Gates. I'm not sure if it was by them originally. The record was held by Juan Arazquin, who scored against Switzerland in 1925 at the age of 18 years and 344 days. Would you like to know, Flo, what was number one on his birthday, the 22nd of June 1906?
How much is that doggy in the window?
Well, it was quite hard to officially find. I'm not sure the charts officially existed, but the only bit of popular music I could discover was Ye Watchers and Ye Holy Ones, a hymn, words by Athelstan Riley, first published in the English Hymnal by Oxford University Press, edited by Percy Dreamer and Ralph Vaughan Williams.
I remember that fondly. What a track.
It's a real banger. It was a floor filler. Back in 1906. We all know, obviously, from the Nations League, Group D is the most exciting one, isn't it? And game of the week was the Faroe Islands v Malta. It was quite an Olsen-y win for the Faroe Islands. Olsen scored after 25 minutes. Malta went 2-1 up. Then a substitute called Olsen equalised in 87 minutes. And then another Olsen got the winner on 90 minutes. And they followed that up with a 1-0 win over Andorra, the only goal scored by Olsen. that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Sid Lowe discussing Lionel Messi staying at Barcelona. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Before we get on to the Carabao Cup first round, let's catch up on the Lionel Messi news with Sid Lowe. Hey, Sid, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, marvellous. Thanks very much. So he did his interview on Friday. What did you make of it?
It's extraordinary, wasn't it? I mean, normally when, even after a scenario like the one we had, in which you've got this very clear, very public, very open breakup, when some sort of resolution is reached, there's normally an attempt to try and, you know, do a kind of a public reconciliation, you know, kiss and make up or draw a line under it, say everything's fine. And he did the complete opposite. He was really direct. I mean, most people will have seen the interview now. If you haven't seen the interview, by the way, go and watch it because it really is worth watching. And he just tore into Barcelona and made it very clear that he was staying because he had no choice, not staying at all happily. You know, I was writing about this and it occurred to me, you know, people talk a lot about acrimonious splits. This was an acrimonious reuniting. it was quite something.
And what's the reaction been?
I sort of almost don't know how to explain it. The reaction has been that this isn't something to celebrate. And yet at the same time, of course it is. Look, on the face of it, Lionel Messi stays for Barcelona is very, very good news. But it kind of wasn't greeted like that. And it wasn't greeted like that, I guess, because it felt to a lot of people, myself included, that it had gone beyond breaking point. Because the way that he then expressed it demonstrated that it had gone beyond breaking point. So now you're looking at this and thinking, well, is this actually a solution? And the reality is it probably isn't for a lot of reasons. I think there's a feeling that this doesn't really mean that anyone's won, although on a superficial level, of course, this is a huge victory for the club's president because he's, you know, managed to make sure that Lionel Messi stays at least for a year. And it was just kind of very flat, I think, the reaction to it. And there was this curious phenomenon that got played out and I think was reinforced with the decision, but got played out in the days leading up to it, which is that those who are most on Lionel Messi's side against Barcelona, amongst Barcelona fans, were probably the ones who most wanted him to leave. And those who had been kind of hurt by this or angered by this were the ones who most wanted him to stay, if you see what I mean. Because those who wanted him to leave almost wanted him to leave for his sake. Now, Lionel Messi has earned this. He's the greatest player we've ever seen. We recognise that the issues are driven by poor club management as much or more than Messi. And therefore, we think it's right that he's kind of earned the right to go. Whereas those who are kind of angry with him, well, you know, this is a matter of principle now. He's really got to stay. So there was this kind of contradictory position there. And I guess as well, maybe the best way of kind of illustrating the reaction to this is that I'm not sure exactly what time it was, but I think at least 3 hours had passed and it was, you know, a fairly wild evening from my point of view, from a work point of view. So apologies if the timings are slightly out, but I think it was at least 3 hours had passed before there had been any reaction from any of Barcelona's official media. Website, Twitter, Instagram. You know, the lead story on Barcelona's website was Philippe Coutinho joins pre-season training. This is 3 hours after what's almost certainly the biggest piece of news in Barcelona for the best part of 25 years. And yet the lead story is Coutinho joins pre-season training. And of course, because that tells you that this had reached a point where this sort of wasn't a thing to celebrate at the same time as it kind of was. And obviously, strategically from Barcelona's point of view, maybe you could argue they couldn't express this on their website because, of course, their whole stance all the way through this was, no, you are just here. This isn't even a thing. You are just here. You stay. You've got a contract. You continue. When finally it was announced, there was a tweet from Barcelona and it was just a photograph of Lionel Messi with the quote from him that I think the quote they chose was, my love for Barcelona will never change or something like that. And I thought, to be honest, I'm quite impressed that in that 15-minute shitstorm of an interview, you managed to fish out the one quote that said that everything's A-OK. And it reminded me of that brilliant Simpsons clip where Homer Simpson's sitting down with the newspaper at breakfast. I think it's USA Today, but forgive me if I've got the wrong one. And he sits down and he says, ah, USA Today, the only newspaper that's not afraid to tell it the way it is, that everything's just fine.
So, Sid, what happens now? Because it's basically, like, Barcelona and Messi are staying together, A, because it's not financially prudent to get divorced, and B, for the sake of the children. Yeah. It's clearly a loveless marriage that can work, can it?
Well, look, I mean, I suppose, and obviously the analogy that a lot of people have been, including myself, by the way, a lot of people have been kind of drawing on over the last few days is that Chicago Bulls Michael Jordan last dance. You know, the idea that at institutional level, the players are not happy with the club, or some of the players are not happy with the club, that there's an awareness that this is a little bit broken now, but look, let's put this behind us and work towards one final big hurrah, one last dance. Now, the issue with that, that analogy at least, is that that was the gang together, which included, of course, Phil Jackson, the coach, which includes Scottie Pippen, which includes Rodman and Jordan. You look at this Barcelona team, well, Messi's best mate, so if you like the Scottie Pippen to Leo Messi's Michael Jordan, is Luis Suarez, and he's going. And the coach has gone as well. And obviously there's been a number of different coaches over the years at Barcelona. So that parallel doesn't entirely stand up. It also doesn't stand up because in personality terms, Messi's not Michael Jordan. And so that kind of changes it as well. But I think you're right. But there is an element of me that thinks maybe what Koeman will try to do now is to try and create a sense that this is the team against the club, if you see what I mean. That, you know, we go out, we fuel this by anger and we go and prove them wrong. But that too has flaws because, I mean, this is intuitive. It's not a piece of information. I'm not entirely sure that this is what Ronald Koeman wanted. You know, Ronald Koeman, who said at his presentation, "I want players at Barcelona who want to be at Barcelona. I don't want players who don't want to be here." And that phrase will be used against him now if things go wrong. I think we'll analyse and overanalyse everything Lionel Messi does all year to, you know, for signs of a split, for signs of a break. I wonder, for example, I mean, even basic questions like, can Lionel Messi seriously still be the captain now? There's lots of elements to this. And one of the other elements which and again, I blame myself in this as much as everybody else, but we haven't really discussed in all of this, is we have a habit, and I've made this mistake, I think, too, as well, of talking about the dressing room as one block. But of course, what that doesn't engage with is the fact that the dressing room isn't one block. And there are players within the dressing room who were actually not that unhappy about the possible prospect of Messi walking away and a shift in culture, a shift in power dynamics, a shift in hierarchies.
And Sid, I mean, you say he can't really be the captain. You couldn't possibly take it off him, though, can they?
Well, that's the thing, exactly. So I mean, and in a way, that's almost illustration of the situation we're in. You know, I do wonder if there will be a conversation at some stage between Koeman and Messi that sort of says, do you want to have this taken off you? You know, do you want the responsibility taken off you? Do you want to back away from this? Do you want to have a year in which you just play? And all of those other things that were part of this process of feeling weighed down by the responsibility, feeling weighed down by having to take a captain's role, which at Spanish clubs, I think possibly more than at English clubs, has an institutional element to it.
Finally, Sid, could you see Barcelona, despite all this, winning La Liga and winning the Champions League?
To be honest, I could see it with Messi going. In that, as I say, there is a bit of me, and absurd though this sounds, and I say this as someone who would argue that Messi is the best player I've ever seen and remains the best player in the world, there was a bit of me that could have seen it more without Messi than with Messi. With Messi, I find it very difficult to see the mechanics that work this. But it's not impossible. Why? Because, you know, this is a team that we're talking about as a disaster, right? But they were one goal away from almost certainly winning the treble last year. If they'd got through Anfield, and forgive me for saying this, Spurs fans, I think they'd have won the treble because they'd have won the European Cup and then they would have probably gone and won the Spanish Copa del Rey as well. Last year, yeah, this year or last year, what year are we in? I don't even know what year we're in. When they lose to Bayern Munich, yeah, that is a complete disaster. But that's still a Champions League quarter final. And so there's a bit of me that thinks, it's not impossible. However dysfunctional it is, it's not impossible. And if Koeman is somehow able to find the mechanics through which this can more or less function, there's quite a lot of good players in that team. I think there's one or two really quite mediocre players as well, by the way. But there are quite a lot of good players. You know, if you've got a team that's got Messi, Griezmann, De Jong, Piqué, Ter Stegen, and for the sake of not overstretching the analogy, I'll stop there. But that's still five players. If you've got a team that's got those five in it, that's potentially really quite a good team.
Sid, nice to talk to you as always.
Pleasure.
Sid Lowe out in Spain. And from Messi to Wessi, as Wes Houlihan's Cambridge United caused the shock of the round with a 1-0 win at Birmingham City in the Carabao Cup. Liam says, is Wessi the GOAT? Quite a few League One and League Two sides knocked out Championship opposition as well. League Two newcomers Harrogate beat Tranmere on penalties. They'll now play West Brom. Luton knocked out Norwich. James Collins got a hat trick.
Sorry. Hold on a second. Back this up. Did you say James Collins got a hat trick?
It can't be that James.
No, Collins. It's a different James Collins. Don't worry.
We should have made more of it if the Ginger Pele had suddenly come out of retirement to score a hat trick for Luton. Salford get to take on Phil Neville's ex-side Everton, given that Phil Neville is part of the class of 92. If you didn't know, they own Salford, so that'll be fun, won't it? Flo, you went to Oxford v AFC Wimbledon. Did you have a nice time?
Yeah, I actually got my car washed because at the Kazam Stadium, there's a car wash that kind of operates sort of half underneath the stadium / by the entrance. So
right, a valet service while you're working. Can fans do that too when they're allowed back in the stadium? That's quite a...
I think so. And lovely. Also, I forgot that it's only got three sides. So I parked my car in the car park and then realised that when AFC Wimbledon's goalies were doing their warm-up, that my car was primed to have its windscreen smashed by a football, going into the air. So I was a little bit worried about that, but it was fine.
People like to hear my amateur football stories. the cleanest I've ever struck a ball is a clearance after the final whistle went of a football match, which sailed over a fence and landed bang in the middle of a windscreen of a Golf GTI, Parks and Road, and just sat there like a sort of plugged golf ball in a bunker. And I had to pay some money to have that replaced. I sort of thought there'd be some sort of amateur club insurance for that. Burnley against Sheffield United, the only all Premier League tie. Minutes after the second round draw, Barry, they did the third round draw.
Yes.
I imagine there's some reason for this, but I couldn't understand why.
Yeah, I don't understand why, and producer Ian attempted to find out why and couldn't. But yeah, sure, you announced the second round draw on TalkSport and then moments later announced the third round draw before the second round draw had actually been played. So I don't get it.
There wasn't even 90 minutes between the second round draw and the third round draw if the teams were to have just played as soon as the draw had been made. Anyway, in the third round, Leicester play Arsenal as Champions League and Europa League qualifiers come in. Man City will play Bournemouth or Crystal Palace. Man United will play Reading or Luton. Liverpool play Bradford or Lincoln. Spurs will play Leyton Orient or Plymouth. There's a question, Jacob, from Matt Walsh, who says, who can I support instead of West Ham? I don't want a successful or competently run club, but one that's entertaining without making me want to take my toaster in the bath. Obviously, Lionel Messi, sat down in front of the cameras and hammered his owners. And on the same day, Mark Noble went on Twitter, and he doesn't tweet a whole lot, does he, to say he was pretty disappointed with the sale of Grady Dean Garner.
Yeah, I think he was upset as well that Messi had decided not to come to West Ham, because I think Messi was quite excited about playing with Lanzini, who he wanted in the 2018 World Cup squad. So that was upsetting for him as well. Yeah, just another crazy spell at West Ham for no particular reason. It felt to me like they were approaching, sort of by their own standards, which is all relative, some kind of stability after finishing the season quite well under Moyes. You know, if you actually look at the stats, they'd scored the most goals outside of the big sides and Arsenal and, you know, obviously Arsenal finished mid-table last season. They had some good wins, and you could sort of see the nucleus of a decent side forming with Bowen and Suchek and Rice and Antonio scoring after being converted into a striker, and kind of looked okay. And although, there hadn't been much business, I think people sort of could kind of accept that there hadn't been much business done by any clubs anywhere because of the impact of the market caused by the pandemic. I think that a lot of clubs outside of Chelsea have been struggling to do anything. And then out of nowhere last week comes the news that Grady Dean Garner is going to West Brom. And it might seem like a little bit strange that a player who's actually not really played that much for West Ham could cause this much anger. I mean, Dean Garner broke into the team under Pellegrini in his first season, and you know he did okay. He didn't totally look up to the standard of the Premier League. There were some flashes here and there. He had a really good debut, and then towards the end of the season he wasn't really playing that much at all. He was mostly off the bench and got loaned out to West Brom in the Championship last season. And when he was at West Brom, he did really well and was a big part of them getting promoted, and they really wanted to bring him back, and it felt like West Brom weren't going to have the money available to do that, felt like, I think Bilic thought that there was no chance of Grady ending up back there, and then out of nowhere the bid comes in and they've accepted it for 18 million, when for a guy who's got 5 years left on his contract, an academy player, people were excited, and he played a lot in pre-season. They thought that he was going to be in the team, and obviously West Ham fans and the club giving great store to the academy down the years. You know, they like to see the kids come through and get in the side. It just feels to me like a bad PR move, because if they'd done this at the start of the window, then there would maybe have been the expectations built up over time that Grady was going to be in the team, and then to do it just a week before the season, it's sort of mixed messages. It looks like they're not entirely sure what they're doing. I understand that there's a need to build up funds, and that they are struggling in a financial sense, and that they wanted to get rid of Felipe Anderson and Lanzini, but compared to Ngannou, they're on big wages, and there's not really a market for them at the moment. When you get the only bid who comes in for, and it comes in for Ngannou, you can sort of see the club's thinking. You can see Moyes' thinking behind it. But at the same time, it still has wound up a significant portion of the fan base who already were extremely annoyed with the owners. You know, before lockdown, there was obviously all the protests that were taking place outside the ground for a couple of games, and you know, obviously now games behind closed doors, that kind of has obviously stopped. But it's just put massive pressure back on the board again, when it did seem like things were going okay. So coming into Saturday's game against Newcastle, the first game at home, it's looking a little bit dodgy for Moyes.
Do they not have the money? Because if they don't have the money, you can't be angry with them for just not being as rich as other football clubs. Are there lots of very legitimate reasons why they should be angry with Golden Sullivan?
Oh, no. I mean, I think that you take the club away from Upton Park and you plonk them in that stadium, then you are making promises, you're building up expectation. And so to come through to, four, you know, what's this? This is going to be, their fifth season in the London Stadium. And, okay, there is a pandemic and you need to be realistic about that. But, you know, when you come into that fifth season, you're not expecting it to be the case that they're having to sell one of their best young players out of the academy to raise funds. That's not what was sold to them, to the fans, basically. I mean, during lockdown, they did a rights issue to raise, I think it was at least £30 million to get a bit of cash into the club. They spent a lot on the Pellegrini. They paid Pellegrini £7 million a year. So they gambled a lot on Pellegrini, I think, and that short-term investment coming off. And they spent a lot on players who really hasn't come off. And they've kind of been now stuck with a few of them. In other cases, they've lost money on sort of transfer fees. And they've sort of got themselves into a bit of a hole. If you look at what they said in the recent accounts, I can't remember the exact loss, but I think it was around 28 million in the last year. So obviously at the same time, Sullivan and Gold are not poor men by any stretch of the imagination. And what fans will always point to as well is that they take the interest out on their loans from the club. So that's kind of pointed at them as well when, you know, they profess to be fans that, you know, at the same time they are taking money out. They don't have a lot of money at the moment to put into the team. They do need to raise it through sales, but there have been a lot of mistakes made along the way and a lot of, you know, essentially promises broken.
Wolves have spent £35 million on a centre-forward, Barry, haven't they? Fabio Silva, signed from Porto on a five-year deal, 18 years old. You pointed out to me yesterday that he scored one senior goal. It must have been an absolute crack, mustn't it?
Yeah, it's a strange transaction. I'm not sure what to make of it. It seems a ridiculously large amount of money to splash out on a player, such a young player with not much experience under his belt. But you'd be inclined to give Wolves the benefit of the doubt, I suppose, because they do seem like a very well-run club. I'm guessing, I haven't checked, that he's a George Mendes client, and you know, this is a George Mendes transfer. His links with Wolves are well documented, but yeah, I would be inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Meanwhile, Newcastle United have agreed a £20 million fee for Callum Wilson. His former teammate Ryan Fraser is also currently up there undergoing talks with the club for the deal is meant to be very close. And they've agreed a fee of £13.5 million to get Jamal Lewis from Norwich, the fullback. It seemed actually, Flo, in a bizarre turn of events, three quite sensible signings by Newcastle United.
Yeah, very sensible. I think lots of people will be trying to poach some of those Norwich players who, as individuals, there's some fantastic individuals there. Max Ahrens is the latest person, I think, who's being linked with a move. So that's a great opportunity, I think, for Premier League clubs to sort of dip into that side who, you know, it just didn't quite work for them and they leaked too many goals. But yeah, there's some standout players in that team. And yeah, it's very sensible. And hopefully the players will be happy with those. And it does seem like from the Newcastle fans that I do follow on Twitter that they're pretty pleased with those additions. And just because they're maybe not some of the other flashy big names that other teams are getting, they're still pleased with it.
I think on the face of it, they do look like three very good signings. But all three of them played in teams that got relegated last season. Jamal Lewis was part of a mainstay in a defence that was comically inept. You know, so if you want to play devil's advocate, you could argue, are they that good? Callum Wilson didn't have a good season. Ryan Fraser, I think his season was interrupted by injury, but then he left Bournemouth high and dry, didn't renew his contract for the run-in, which got them relegated and which they were awful. So I think if you were one of those Newcastle fans who's determined to see the bad in everything and to criticise every single thing Steve Bruce does, whether it works or not, you could argue that they're not particularly good signings, even though I think, yes, they are.
Or if you were a Newcastle fan who had a tiny bit of hope going into this season, it's all been shattered by Barry in a matter of seconds. Yes, Flo?
I was going to say, no, I definitely agree with parts of that Barry said. I think 20 million for Callum Wilson, who obviously has a long career of bad injuries and time out the game, perhaps you maybe would have wanted to spend that money on someone else. I think he always has shown flickers of being a fantastic striker, got a little bit of time in the England team as well. But those injuries are definitely a concern. So I would say, yeah, 20 million quid when you're a club that isn't famous for spending a lot of money that consistently, maybe recently a lot has been spent, then I can understand why fans are maybe thinking, is this the right option for that amount of money?
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin with the Women's Super League. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So the WSL then kicked off. Manchester United 1, Chelsea 1. Sam Kerr got one, could and should have got more. I mean, Chelsea could have had this game out of sight, Flo, couldn't they, before Man United equalised?
Yeah, it was kind of a little bit classic Chelsea. In the last couple of years, they've sometimes started seasons quite slowly and struggled to score goals. And I think we saw a little bit of that yesterday and perhaps some of what could be their weakness throughout the season with trying to patch these group of exceptional players together and sort of create one unit. On paper, they've got an incredible starting 11 and, you know, almost an even better bench to come on and support. But they're still sort of working their way through it and had so many players come in, players who were still quarantining, etc. So I think it's gonna take a while. And because there's only 12 teams in the league, you know, perhaps this is the first sign that Chelsea aren't going to walk away with it, because if you do drop points in a small league, there's not a lot of games to make them back. So if Manchester City or Arsenal carry on their fantastic form from the first weekend, then Chelsea could find themselves, you know, quite far behind.
You mentioned Arsenal. They hammered Reading 6-1. Jill Roord scored a hat-trick. Kim Little got a lovely volley. Two for Miedemar. One was Yeboah'd in off the bar. I mean, it was so straightforward. But they played some lovely, intricate football, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Arsenal were at their finest yesterday. They played such nice football. And yesterday was the perfect display of that. So many exceptional team goals, and that's what they do so well. I mean, they're very Arsenal in their identity, and I think that's what's great. And I think some fans were disappointed that Man City and Chelsea were bringing in such big global names and Arsenal had been a bit quiet compared, but they've kept that unit together. They've bought players that the manager knows, they've bought smartly, they haven't spent a lot of money, but they've bought key players that they needed, and they've kept that pack together. And you know, Jill Roord scored a hat-trick yesterday. She's going into her second season with Arsenal, and she's going to be, you know, an exceptional talent who doesn't really get injured too much, and that has been a problem for some of their other players. Kim Little scored such a good volley yesterday. Miedemar scored such a good goal. So I think Arsenal may be proving some people wrong who thought that it's all going to be about Man City and Chelsea this season.
I don't know how many contacts you have at Arsenal, Flo, but the use of the goal music without fans, especially the worst goal music of all the goal musics, the da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da. I mean, six times to play that. Do they not? I mean, who's it for? Like, what is the point of... I mean, it's terrible when there are... There are no fans there. What is the point of that?
I don't know. It also is horrible. I don't even like having the PA announcer on as well, because you've got someone who's getting really overexcited about someone scoring a goal, and they're just announcing it to the subs bench. It's like... And your goal scorer is number, and you just think, what? Like, come on, can you just save your energy? And it also is just a horrible noise on the commentary. So
you would think the PA announcer should just go around and quietly tell anyone who's there what's just happened.
Say, in case you missed it, in case you were grabbing a drink, Miedemar just scored a really nice goal.
What you hope they don't do is that. What the worst PA trait, which is just to announce the Christian name very loudly and hope the subs bench fill in and yell the surname of the goal scorer. A Man City won 2-0 at Villa, brace for Georgia Stanway. I mean, the two just ridiculous pieces of defending. I mean, it was just hilarious, Flo.
Yeah, it was definitely one of those wake-up calls for Aston Villa, and you probably wouldn't want to start, well, you definitely wouldn't want to start the season that way, but it was a wake-up call and a realisation that they're playing with the big boys now, and you can't spend, you know, a few minutes playing it nicely out the back and not have any pressure on you. And they completely walked the championship last season, were unbeaten, well-deserved, and were promoted. So I think that was definitely a bit of a shock to the system, and the fact that they had to start against Man City was probably not ideal, because they would have liked to work their way into this league. But unfortunately, you know, hopefully they can improve from that, because they were two pretty terrible errors.
On to some questions now. Matty says, how do you think you would fare in Soccer Aid? While Ben says, did Barry get the call to fill in for Yaya Toure on Soccer Aid? If so, what is his offer to his teammates on the WhatsApp group? Is this offer any different to the pod WhatsApp? Yes, Yaya Toure got thrown out of Soccer Aid for sending offensive messages on WhatsApp, and then apologised, saying it was just a bit of banter. I'd like to say that this WhatsApp group is nothing of the sort. Would you agree, Barry?
Yeah, I'd actually heard that story about Yaya Toure ages ago. I was sitting on a massive scoop.
Michael says, can the panel name a similar Djokovic incident in football, read the US Open? Andre Baigi getting sent off for pushing a paramedic in the 2008 African Cup of Nations springs to mind. I think pushing a paramedic seems a foolish thing to do. Travis says, what's the worst thing that has ever been hit, thrown at you? I saw, Jacob, you found it mildly amusing that Novak Djokovic was thrown out of the US Open for this misdemeanour.
I've done it before as well. We've been lucky to get away with it. I think it was at the 2016 O2 tournament where he hit a ball into the crowd and it missed somebody. And afterwards he was saying that it wasn't a problem, but it turns out that it is a problem. So, yeah, I was thinking Eden Hazard. Remember when he kicked a ball boy or whatever it was?
Yeah, that's what I was going to think of. Was it against Swansea, was it?
Yeah, in the League Cup.
Yeah, the ball boy went quite rugby league, didn't he? He was like, I'm not letting go of this. He just wanted to roll it through his legs, and Eden Hazard was just kicking it from underneath him. Yes, Barry, Travis wanted to know, what's the worst thing that's ever been thrown at you?
A rock.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite a good answer. And Michael Fine says, in an old episode, Barry mentioned a rather raucous night you and he had in Melbourne. We're locked down pretty tight here at the moment. Could you or Barry please remind me of what our vibrant nightlife was like by way of a blow-by-blow account of the night's events? I'm going to say, from my part, I can't remember.
I just remember you were out. It's the most inebriated I've ever seen you by a considerable distance. I was there with some of my Aussie mates, and I can't remember where we were, but it was, yeah, it was a good night out.
It was.
Melbourne's a great town to go out in.
Yeah, and we wish everybody who is locked down over there well, and hope you get out of it soon. Thanks for your time today, Flo.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, Jacob.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Wednesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.